This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, you don't have to be a news hound to know that the Pulitzer Prize is the highest honor in American journalism. This year, as usual, most of the Pulitzers went to big city newspapers, the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal among them. But for the first time in more than 90 years, the Pulitzer jury gave no award for breaking local news coverage. So is the Pulitzer jury's decision a sign that journalism in America, especially local journalism, is in decline? And if so, who will keep an eye on those local officials, police, and politicians if the Fourth Estate is not around to do it? Joining me to take a look at the state of local journalism is Andy Bechtel. He's an assistant professor of journalism at UNC Chapel Hill. Fiona Morgan is a graduate student in public policy at Duke University and a research fellow at the New America Foundation. And Kevin Davis is editor of the blog Bull City Rising, which covers current events in Durham. I want to welcome all of you to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Thank you, Frank.
Andy, tell us what the Pulitzer jury looks for when it considers awarding a prize for breaking news.
Sure. Well, obviously, from the title, breaking news, it's a coverage of events that are happening now, perhaps spontaneously as a surprise. A lot of the awards over the years have been for coverage, for example, of the LA riots. Los Angeles Times won for that. A great example also would be the Times-Picayune winning for the Katrina coverage in New Orleans. So the committee's always looked at, Pulitzer committee's looked at that kind of large-scale effort in its sort of adversity. And this year it was a very surprising result with that, because you had several contenders there I think were certainly worthy. And the three finalists, probably the one that struck me as the most odd, was the Miami Herald did fantastic coverage of the earthquake in Haiti. Now, that's not in Miami, but I think you could argue that Miami is connected to Haiti in a way that almost makes that a local story as well as a global story.
Well, I have to just interrupt for a moment. It's the category is breaking news, but the implication is that it will be local news.
Sure, right. That's the way the Pulitzers
are
set up.
Watergate doesn't qualify in this case,
right?
Because it's a breaking news story, but it's not. It's a national news,
right? And that's more of an investigative story, also, where they dug deep and took some time to do that. Versus suddenly an earthquake hits or a city is hit by riots, those kinds of things.
So, what does it mean, do you think? And we can go around the table here when the Pulitzer jury says nobody's coverage of anything in their backyard was worthy of this award. Does that mean it was all that bad, or the Pulitzer jury is out of it?
Well, I would say, just to give their point of view from the Pulitzer people, is they said that there was no standout coverage this year, and this is just a fluke year. But it does raise the issue of what's happening with our media locally with all the cutbacks we've been seeing. Just yesterday, for example, here in North Carolina with the News and Observer reducing another 20 jobs, including 11 in the newsroom. And that brings back the question of what is the future of local journalism, because it takes time, it takes effort, it takes money to get information to readers, to viewers, and it's not a simple task. And we're seeing, you know, a lot of alternative sources popping up, which is really a fascinating thing, too.
Well, Fiona, I know you've done some research for New America Foundation. You've compiled a report that details how Triangle residents get their news. Where do we get our news?
Well, we get our news from a very wide variety of sources. One of the things that my report, the approach that I tried to take, was about information needs, not just an overview of what are the traditional media outlets, mm-hmm. although those are definitely detailed in the report, but also if you are a citizen and you live, or even if you're not, if you're a resident and you live here and you want to know what's happening in your community, what are the needs that you have? How well are they being met? And how well are you able to engage with the news that you have? So I looked at all the metro media in the Triangle, which would be the News and Observer newspaper, of course, the broadcast news outlets. There's a lot of information about WRAL. There's information about WNC in there, which, of course, is a statewide organization but does a lot of coverage of the Triangle. There's also the Independent Weekly, where I was a reporter for about 6 years, which tries to cover the Triangle. And it's a challenge. But there's also lots of blogs that I tried to look at. Are there innovative business models? Are there nonprofit news organizations? What's the role of campus media? Universities like UNC Chapel Hill that have a really robust journalism department. The other thing that I found was interesting is that there's a lot of people who are very intelligent and engaged in their community and want to contribute in some way. That can be bloggers like Kevin Davis, who's just a resident of Durham, loves Durham, and wants to make sure that it gets coverage, Or it can be people tweeting. It can be people contributing in a kind of even less obvious way. So I think that we have fewer reporters, which is a big problem. It's not that reporting is rocket science. It's not that it's so difficult to do, but it is really time consuming. It's very hard for in the case of breaking news, it's really hard to get the story right and get it quick and get it to people, get the information to people that they need. You see that with any kind of natural disaster, any kind of big event. The first report is sometimes wrong. The things you hear on social media can be wrong. And so a reporter's role is really to verify that, get that news out there. It's also to figure out why do things happen. If a bridge collapses, that's years in the making, right?
So really. Well, and you have to understand, too, I mean, the science is in the experience of knowing when to keep checking and knowing that these reports might be false and then having an editorial staff, an editor behind you who's going to help vet all those things. I don't think everybody realizes how much good staffing goes behind this. Kevin, you provide a lot of local news in Bull City Rising. Do you consider yourself a reporter? Are you a replacement for some of what we're losing these days?
Well, I certainly consider myself to be doing local reporting and do news coverage, but I've been quick to tell anyone who'll listen that it's not a stand-in replacement for the kind of professional news gathering that we've had for so long from the News and Observer or the Herald Sun and other outlets. Concerns there are it's when any time you have citizen journalists or whatever today's catchphrase is for that, you are an individual resource going in there. There's not that backup. There's not the editorial layer. If you have issues in a personal life, a work life gets busy, that passion will take a back seat. So that's the first challenge. And that translates to a challenge for the community as well. And the comprehensiveness of the coverage, the ethics and professionalism of the coverage. I've been fortunate to build up a good readership and usually do the right thing with my coverage. But all the community has is the trust of what one individual is doing. If I do a lousy job, there's not an editor and publisher to fire me and hire someone new to take my place, that voice goes silent. So I think there's a civic responsibility we have to ensure we have good, continuous local news coverage. I see my role sometimes to amplify, particularly stories that aren't getting covered, to try and fill in where other organizations may not have the staffing to catch it, or to try and do longer analytical pieces that don't fit into the time slots that television broadcast can do. They don't fit into the column inches that a newspaper can give. So I see it as augmenting, but I see the work I'm doing is one step along the way to a solution we need to reach.
And I know in public broadcasting, we have a news department here that does an excellent job on the kind of feature reporting that they do, in-depth coverage, but not the kind of staff power that it requires to cover every city council meeting, every school board meeting, and to do it in a comprehensive way, develop those sources all over the state or even all over the region. It's not what we're designed to do, not as a primary source of news the way a newspaper is. Now, WUNC becomes a primary source for national and international news. When you hear the big news in the news conference, tune quickly to WUNC and to public radio. Local news, we don't have the kind of staff and never to do that sort of thing. So we do what we do very well, and it's not as a primary source of local news. So we'll talk more about that. We're going to take a break right now and figure out and maybe find out how we help pay for all of what we do here in public radio on the state of things. You'll have a chance to do that. And then when that's all over, come on back and listen to our conversation about local news coverage on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're looking at the state of local journalism. My guests are Andy Bechtel, journalism professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Fiona Morgan's a Duke grad student and research fellow at the New America Foundation. Kevin Davis is editor of the Durham blog, Bull City Rising. Andy, recently Bell, California found out that its city council was giving itself exorbitant salaries, wasn't telling any of that to the public, and the LA Times found out about it. They covered the scandal, but it took a long time. They won an award for it, but
yes,
they wanted to take a while.
They won a Pulitzer for it, as very well deserved. Excellent reporting, excellent investigative reporting, and I think that's the distinction there. And Bell is within the circulation area of the LA Times, the print product, and of course, the website would go all over the world. But in any event, but if you think about it, even in the heyday for the Los Angeles Times, to cover every city council meeting of every town in Southern California is very difficult. And with the layoffs and cutbacks there, among other places over the years, they're really having to pick and choose what communities they cover in depth. And my hat's off to the Los Angeles Times for the great work exposing that corruption in Bell. It's a great example of watchdog journalism. At the same time, you think about other situations like that could be happening elsewhere. We just don't know it because we're not getting that day-in, day-out coverage from our television stations, from our newspapers, from our websites that maybe we'd like to see.
And it took how long? I mean, these guys have been lining their pockets for...
For years. Honest, for years. And right. We're talking about close to $1 million salaries for people who, once that was found out, the community was outraged by that. So,
and this is the kind of thing that newspapers, as you suggest, even when they were fully staffed, this would be a hard thing to do. Fiona, I know you're looking at this right now across North Carolina, what smaller towns are doing in the absence of this kind of news coverage.
Yeah, part of my research in public policy is looking at trying to sort of pose the question, how many more bells are there out there? One of the things that's interesting about that story is that the people that were citizens in Bell had been trying to get information, really fundamental public records, just how much are our public servants being paid here, and they couldn't get the information, even though it was rightly a public record. It really took the institutional power of the Los Angeles Times to wrest those records, and I think we've definitely seen that sort of tangle over public records laws in North Carolina recently. It's really important, too, to know that citizens are going to have to be the ones in their local communities to be watchdogs. One thing that I think as reporters we sort of have to acknowledge is that we've always needed the public to be sources for us. It's not that we just sort of magically knew things happening and we didn't always know what was the story to cover. We really rely on citizens to tip us off to things, to provide us with records. Sometimes if someone's blogging a council meeting or just showing up and bringing the agenda and drawing things to our attention, citizens have a power to be agenda setters for the media as we try to make use of the really limited resources that we have.
And Kevin, I'm sure that that's a very important part of what you're doing. Of course, new technology is what allowed citizen journalists to the proliferation and the proliferation of blogs. So we thought we were going to move into this new frontier of much more citizen journalism and much more openness. And it really hasn't worked that way, even for people like you in the business, trying to make it work.
You know, it really hasn't, Frank. And I think there's a few constraints on that. One of the constraints, unfortunately, is when you go into citizen journalism and go into it with the greatest of optimism about people wanting to have this information and know these things, you find very quickly when you look at what stories get traffic, you understand why the car crash leads the evening news or the front page of a paper, because the stories that draw the most traffic and comments are those that, frankly, I might not think are always the most journalistically valid, but you can do a dive into public records and find great information and find that it's appreciated. It may work its way into the media ecosystem, and it plays an important role for that, but there's not that immediate reward that, you know, in my case, I have a day job that pays me. I don't do this for financial gain. If I relied on ad sales to pay the mortgage, I'd be in trouble, and it would certainly color to a greater extent the work that I do. I would add also that there have certainly been times where, you know, I've, you know, in collaborating as just, you know, colleagues, as it were, asymmetrical colleagues, I've shared, you know, topics with many colleagues around the community and let them know about stories that may be too large for my site to handle. And sometimes those have gotten picked up. More concerning to me have been times where, you know, maybe the subject in the private sector, you know, wasn't always, you know, considered public record material to go after. Maybe they're a large advertiser. Maybe those aren't interesting stories. So to me, the diminution of local media isn't just about the challenges we have replacing it. It's can a traditional newspaper or TV station or radio station that faces funding challenges and risk actually go after larger investigative stories, particularly those that don't start and end within the government sector.
Well, the challenges then are around funding. I mean, you don't have to draw a lot of the amount of traffic you get would mean less if people who cared about more important things were paying for that kind of news. But if the funding mechanism depends on advertising and then has to pay shareholders on top of its operating budget, well, that's why newspapers are going out of business. So the question is, are there new models? Certainly we can look at the nonprofit model. It works for public radio, right? And it works for pro media. And maybe, Andy, I'll have you talk a little bit about pro media and how that works. There's good investigative journalism being done at that level.
ProPublica?
ProPublica.
Sure, that's right. Yeah, that's one of the newer models that's out there. And they've now won Pulitzer Prizes. And in conjunction, though, with more traditional media like the New York Times, they're an online-only publication. And it is a hopeful sign in that we can see that investigative side work that way at a larger national level. Right. And that's what they're doing so far, and fantastic work to be sure. I think the challenge is going to be, how do we make that work on a smaller scale? So that we know what's happening on the national level, but also what's happening in Durham or Carpero or Apex or wherever you may live.
Well, who's paying for ProPublica?
I believe it's a grants-oriented situation. We're seeing more of that. We're seeing some nonprofit ideas coming out, entrepreneurial journalism. We can talk about that too, more solo freelance type people working as well. And it's a great question because the real problem with what's happening with traditional media is the advertising for print media is simply drying up. And it's a great question. Even if the economy came back, would it come back strong enough to support what we had before? And so that's a big issue, is how do we pay for journalism? It's an expensive enterprise to cover day-to-day activities in your community or to do an investigative piece. It's not a simple thing.
So it's these mid-level, like local newspapers in cities like Raleigh and metropolitan areas that are really suffering at the very micro level. It's a fairly inexpensive enterprise, so you can maybe get the coverage going. Although a newspaper in Garner just went out of business.
That's right. The Garner Citizen, which in my research, I talked to people that lived in Garner, and I asked them, what do you read to get the news? And almost to a person, they said, oh, the Garner Citizen, they really cover us. Even though there are two other weekly newspapers that ostensibly cover Garner, have Garner in the name, the Garner Citizen was so committed to really watchdog day in, day out, showing up at the meetings and just very focused on the community. It was started by a retired police officer with no journalism background who just really wanted better coverage. So I don't know financially why they ceased print publication, and I don't know what's going to happen. I know they want to stay online, but they let go of their reporter. So there's a disconnect between how successful something is in terms of the news that they put out and the reception in the community and their financial footing.
Is there anything we can learn from the public radio model? I mean, think about it, and listeners are being reminded this all week. This is a service that's free, and people have volunteered to pay for it because clearly they understand that it will not happen if they don't. There's a clear understanding that that's the truth, and more than half of our funding comes from listeners. Very little now comes from the government of any kind, none from the state, a little from the federal government. So are those people who are desperately interested in good news coverage enough? Can they support local news of the kind of quality and with the intensity that we're talking about?
I think it's possible, certainly possible. I think the models that are working, that where people are willing to pay for online news, for example, or when you have really exclusive information that's not available all over the place. And the New York Times is obviously trying this right now. They're calling it a paywall, not a pledge, but they're trying this. Very curious to see how that's going to turn out. And even in some areas in sports journalism, for example, that seems to be working because some people out there want that information so badly, they value it so heavily that they're willing to pay for it in some form or fashion. But can that be enough to sustain a journalism enterprise such as the News and Observer or a large organization like that? Probably not. It's going to be a challenge to make that work. But at the same time, smaller operations, I think it could work.
And could it be, you know, a kind of small profit model where you break away from the nonprofit, the restrictions? Because we're probably at the lid. We're a very good operation here. It's not going to get too much bigger, and we'll never be an investigative unit under a nonprofit model. Small profit allows you to make money. It allows you to put up a paywall, drop in your dime, I'll give you the report, and subscribe the way people do right now. But you don't have to pay off those shareholders who, frankly, don't contribute a thing.
You know, it's absolutely a possibility, and I think we're likely to see more experimentation in that, just as we are seeing in the nonprofit model. There's certainly been some depressing developments as the Rocky Mountain News disappeared. I believe a paper in Seattle disappeared, and some of the not going through a true, you know, L3C type of model, but as you actually saw professional journalists try and say, hey, let's go start an online only ourselves, even in fairly large cities, and get even a modest subscriber base of, I think, 20,000 was the target in one case, and had a hard time attracting the level of subscribers you'd need. I think what we haven't seen is a modest-sized to mid-sized community left with no other news source, where the only option is we need to think of a new engagement. You've seen a lot of two newspaper towns go to a single paper, that weakening of resources. I think the real question will become when people don't have another choice, is there that willingness to invest in the news coverage that we've historically, at least in the 20th century, considered to be a civic birthright?
Yeah, but here's the scary thing. They are looking at something. And the question is, are we being, our eyes and our minds being so, are we distracted by other things? We don't think we need it anymore. that happening? Well, before we sort of speculate on whether or not we stop caring about news, let's look at one model at the publicly traded level, AOL, which is going to go out of business if they don't figure out something, right, has come up with this patch model. Maybe you can explain patch, a hyper-local it's a hyper-local system that is going to be plugged into a kind of a national aggregator. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can explain it for us.
Sure. AOL Patch goes into metro regions and looks at the wealthier suburban towns around them historically. They claim they're the largest employer of recent J-school graduates, you know, hiring hundreds of people a year, and they'll plunk them down at a $40,000 or so a year salary. They will, within a region, let's say the New York area, they'll have a bunch of these patch sites as local news sites for Westchester County towns, let's say. They'll have an editor who supervises 10 or 15 towns, and then a couple of ad sales staff for each one of the areas. And the theory is, if you have a large story in one town, maybe the patch reporter for that town reports on it, and the four neighboring towns all run that on their site. Basically, what they're trying to do is exactly what Fiona was talking about exploiting that local town coverage in a Garner type of situation, where people will be really passionate for the great news they're not getting from the big city paper that might be focused on the central city. To me, I think it's great to see people investing in local journalism. The fear a lot of folks have, I think, is that AOL is also engaged a great deal in demand media or content farm style media, where there's and the Huffington Post, which they've recently merged with, has a history of this as well. Let's look at what are the biggest Google searches. What are those things that people are most interested in, and we'll pay someone to write a story on that. And I think there's a natural nervousness about, if you're that driven by finances and you're also financially in peril, at least you have been in recent years, are you going to stick with the kind of commitment to quality local news coverage that it takes? Or will you be saying, what's popular? You know, let's follow what the food blogs do. Everyone reads the food blogs. Let's focus on those areas.
Journalism as an industry grew out of a competitive spirit and a for-profit motive. But now we see that some of the more successful enterprises in serious journalism, like public radio, public television, and ProPublica, they're not competitive at all. I mean, they have no competition in a sense. Are we looking at a model that re-envisions what it is we do and the way we do business, a more cooperative model that brings sources together, brings professionals together in a way that's financially sustainable?
That's a good question. You know, I think it's interesting to note that there was an example, sort of like Patch, an experiment that was tried here in the Triangle. NBC17 tried a MyNC network. And in my report, I sort of detailed the whole story. But basically, Barry Loeffler, who was the head of NBC17, worked for its parent company, tried a web-first, hyper-local media where he had reporters stationed in local communities throughout the Triangle. They would write at least one story a week. It was usually multimedia with video. And once a month from each community, they'd pull that into their broadcast. And he told me that one of the reasons that they did that was that they were hearing from local advertisers that they wanted to have a way to advertise, but they couldn't afford to buy time on the television broadcast. And so the hyperlocal web was actually partly driven by demand from advertising, which I think is hopeful. In the end, they discontinued that experiment, but I wonder if that has more to do with their parent company, Media General, and their financial needs than it did with the financial viability. And there's also interest, I think, in nonprofit media in the Triangle. There's a really interesting sort of startup nonprofit called Raleigh Public Record, which has been getting a lot of community support. It's also gotten a recent grant from the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation, so they now have at least one professional staffer now who can keep it going. So I'd like to see that grow.
I want to thank you all for being on the program today and speculating on the future of local journalism. Andy Bechtel is an assistant professor of journalism at UNC Chapel Hill. He's got a blog, editdesk.wordpress.com. Fiona Morgan will complete her master's at Duke University this spring. She's landed a research position with the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke Sanford School of Public Policy. Kevin Davis is editor of the blog Bull City Rising, which you can read at bullcityrising.com. Just ahead, the Raleigh Ensemble Players celebrate their new theater space with a production of the play Distracted. Stay with us.